What's up, everybody? My name is Dimitri Kofinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, a podcast that inspires investors, entrepreneurs, and everyday citizens to challenge consensus narratives and to learn how to think critically about the systems of power shaping our world. I had an opportunity to be interviewed recently for a new podcast that styles itself as a sort of documentary series where the host, Bradford Pope MacArthur, interviews many of the same people that you will have heard on this podcast over the years, including our recent guest Simon Mihaljevic, but also folks like Michael Kazin, the biographer of William Jennings Bryan, who had appeared on my old TV show years ago, and which was really one of my favorite episodes at the time. The podcast slash documentary is titled The Empire's New Clothes, and it examines the cyclical forces that make and break empires and tries to answer the big questions of how we got here as a society and what might be in store for us in the years to come. This is now, I think, either the 14th or 15th podcast that I've been on in the last couple of years, and I've really enjoyed doing these, even though I haven't republished most of them on the Hidden Forces feed, and that includes podcasts like Barron's Advisor with Steve Sandusky, The Breakdown with Nathaniel Whitmore, where he gives a phenomenal daily analysis of the big picture power shifts in crypto, markets, and geopolitics, or Michael Ippolito, who you may remember from his appearance on Hidden Forces and who recently started his own podcast for Blockworks called On the Margin. All of these folks are doing a great job and in some cases are absolutely crushing it. So I'm genuinely fortunate to be invited on their shows and to get a chance to share my opinions, ideas, thoughts, and perspectives on markets, politics, geopolitics, culture, philosophy, basically anything and everything that I'm thinking about, but that I don't really have a chance to elaborate on my own podcast. You can find more information about Bradford's podcast at theempiresclothes.com. And as always, you can learn more about Hidden Forces, listen to previous episodes, and sign up for our premium content through the Hidden Forces website at hiddenforces.io. And with that, please enjoy my recent appearance on The Empire's New Clothes with host Bradford MacArthur.
Dimitri, thanks so much for coming on today. Really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Well, so little backstory here. I've listened to a lot of your podcasts. You bring on some fascinating guests. I've noticed we have a little bit of crossover. And I've been very excited to talk to you because you have a very similar, be it curiosity, vision, motive for your show. You're looking at the hidden forces of markets. And we're looking at the hidden forces of empires. And so I would love to know, what brought you there? Where did this curiosity come from?
Well, I don't know where the curiosity came from. I've always had that curiosity. I recently actually interviewed a guest, James Aitken, who said the same thing, that when he was a kid, he would always look at things from a very early age and be like, well, how does that work? Or like, why does that work that way? And I would always be that way. So I always had a curiosity. And that curiosity found a natural outlet in financial markets, because I think in retrospect, they're endlessly complex and you can never really get to the bottom of anything. And when you don't know that, you can easily get sucked into them because you think that you're going to figure it out. Mm-hmm. I'd say I had a similar experience with philosophy, actually. When I first began to study philosophy as a high school student, then as an undergraduate, I had this idea that I would be able to figure it out. I'd be able to figure out the nature of existence. But you realize that there's a reason why these questions have persisted over time. So the same is true of financial markets. And Hidden Forces was something that I came to, this idea of doing a podcast called Hidden Forces, because I asked myself the question, what was it that attracted me so much to financial markets? And I came to the realization that it wasn't specifically because it had to do with money or the economy, but rather because it was this infinitely complex data set. And also because of the social science component, which again, it speaks to the complexity. And I was always interested in, well, what's driving the market? Can I get deeper down the vector of what's really happening here? And I wanted to apply that curiosity and that framework, or rather perhaps the frameworks that I applied to understanding financial markets, mm-hmm. to the broader world. And then to find a way to make that useful for investors specifically, because I recognized that there was an opportunity to service that community. I was well aware of and familiar with the newsletter industry because I used to read financial newsletters going back to when I was a senior in high school. So it was a way to make this work, to find an audience, an initial audience that I could target, but then with the eventual goal of scaling it to a broader community of people who were just interested in this stuff.
That's super cool. And so what have you found so far?
What have I found so far? Well, I have more questions than answers probably. It's interesting.
That's how it goes.
Yeah, it's
it?
Interesting. What I would say is what's interesting is how my interests and focus have evolved. Early on, I have, in terms of my career, a background in tech, so to speak, specifically in the video game industry and in the application development and design side of television's UX, UI. And that's how I ended up transitioning into content. I was always interested in content, specifically documentary film. And so I eventually made that transition onto the content side, but my background was in tech. And when I started Hidden Forces, I wanted to reacquaint myself with my passion for that stuff, for the sciences, for technology, for math. So if you look early on, my episodes were mathematics, episodes on philosophical mathematics, science, philosophy of science, philosophy in general. But as time went on, I naturally gravitated back to, surprise, surprise, the things that I seemed to always enjoy, which were not just finance and markets, but also geopolitics and foreign affairs, which is what one of my majors was. I majored in both economics and politics, specifically with an emphasis on foreign policy and international relations, and a minor in psychology. That and the interplay of culture are the things that most interest me, it seems. That's where my focus has gone.
Yeah, that's a very interesting cocktail of studies. It sounds like early on you kind of had a bit of a vision of, I don't know if vision's a bit too heavy, but you're saying you studied or you're interested in philosophy in high school. I was 100% not interested in philosophy in high school.
What were your interests?
And then all in high school, I was obsessed with climbing. I just climbed.
Oh, interesting. Okay. But so yeah. You were entirely focused on athletics?
I don't know about entirely. I grew up in Atlanta, and so I was interested in, I was going to concerts. I was doing like high school stuff.
Right.
I wasn't interested in like pondering these big questions.
Interesting.
I was just a kid living, didn't really know what I wanted to do, just having fun. But it sounds like you had some very interesting endeavors for that age, and then they are still relevant today, which I find quite fascinating, actually. And so I've noticed that philosophy does play a pretty good role in Hidden Forces. Do you find that helps you think about markets in any capacity?
I'm sure it does. In retrospect, I might have considered majoring in philosophy. I was dissuaded from doing so by my parents, who told me that I would end up like Socrates or on the streets of Athens without a home, without any money. But in retrospect, that was obviously not correct. I think people that study philosophy can apply themselves to all sorts of areas of work and towards solving all sorts of problems because it's a modality of thinking. So yes, I'm sure it does help me. I don't have an immediate way to think about that. The way that I've thought about this concept of financial nihilism, which I've talked about in a series of other interviews, probably came from that, from reading Nietzsche and other philosophers and thinking about reality versus perception, value versus price, and what happens when our notions of value, we're disabused of those, and the nihilism comes out of that. So I think that's one area where it's probably helped me.
Well, maybe let's dive into that a little bit, because I know you have spoken a bit about this idea of financial nihilism, and I would certainly love to hear some more of your thoughts and perhaps to the viewers, like, what is that and how did you start to reach some of these conclusions and observations?
Well, I sort of roughly define financial nihilism or market nihilism as an investing philosophy or an investment philosophy that views the objects of speculation as though they were intrinsically worthless. And this is a meaningful departure from a framework that I had used up until this point, which was informed by people like Karl Popper and most specifically George Soros, who borrowed so much from Popper, which is that there is an empirical world. That world has value that we can discern, and that there is a perceptual layer of reality, and that that is where price exists. And to the extent that the two diverge, represents opportunities either for remaining in cash with optionality or actually being invested. In other words, if price exceeds value, you want to stay on the sidelines. If value exceeds price, in other words, if something is undervalued, then you want to be invested. I still believe this to be true. I still think there is an empirical reality, a discernible, an objectively discernible reality. And I still think that our perception of reality is never perfectly aligned with it. However, I think that we are in a phase now where people's confidence in that type of model has been dramatically shaken. Their confidence in the values that they grew up with, their confidence in institutions, all of those things. And out of that is born this nihilism. And I specifically call it financial nihilism because we've seen it on display in financial markets with respect specifically to meme stocks, also in cryptocurrencies. And it's this idea that, well, reality really doesn't matter. What matters is perception entirely. But one step further, concluding that we can alter perception permanently and exist entirely within that perceptual realm and never have to be accountable to what's happening in the real world. And I think that's not just troubling. I think it's ultimately false. But we're living through a period where you have to understand that, I think, in order to invest.
And then your personal beliefs there, do you, I mean, I feel like you kind of hinted at that, but do you agree with that? And do you look at that as an investment framework for yourself just because it's so prevalent?
I certainly have invested accordingly. I've had to. Mm-hmm. It's not like a comfort zone for me. I operate much better in a world where I can value something and then I can determine whether it's over or undervalued. Mm-hmm. But I have selectively speculated with this framework in mind. A perfect example is an episode I did on Ethereum. Ethereum ultrasound money, the concept of ultrasound money, and EIP 1559 and proof of stake. And to the extent that I don't talk much about my personal investments insofar as they don't conflict with anything I do. And I certainly make disclaimers, but I never create content with the purpose of pumping any particular thing. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that I've invested in Ethereum or speculated rather, it's been primarily because of that thesis and not because of the underlying value of the network, which I think is no longer possible to meaningfully discern, or at least not for me. One, I think it's important to point out that cryptocurrencies and blockchains and these networks in general, in order to understand them, you have to devote a lot of time. And most people just don't have the time to do that. So most of the money that's invested in the space is, quote, dumb money. And so one, there's that. And then two, it's very difficult to discern value because the heuristics that most of us depend on in order to determine whether or not something is valuable or how valuable it is are broken because of the tidal waves of liquidity and the rampant optimism in the space. But that doesn't mean that you can't speculate on the margin, and I think responsibly, by using some of these models around financial nihilism that, you know, I've developed, that I think about, that I've talked about on the podcast and most specifically in other interviews.
Well, it's interesting. This also makes me think of, and folks listening have maybe heard me say this before in other interviews, but it seems like we're living in a post-truth world. And I've heard you say before that our goal should be to create a more equitable society that is self-correcting. And to be self-correcting, there needs to be some core vision the majority agree on. And so if everything can be relativized, then it seems challenging to imagine a reality or a future where we all have that core truth, that core belief that can guide society self-correcting. And so this is kind of like a philosophical question for you. do we need a different philosophical foundation, a non-post-truth culture before this can happen? Or is it possible to create a core vision that society can self-correct around it within the current state of affairs?
When you say within the current state of affairs, are you saying, can we live as a society in a post-truth world, i.e. in a world where everyone more or less no longer believes in empirically discernible consensus truth?
Yeah. So I think in one part, there's a element of how people behave and act, and they will say things like, everyone must create their own truth, or there is no truth.
Sure. Live your truth.
Exactly. And there's built-in contradictions to that, because you're stating an absolute truth claim, of course. So there's in one way this like contradictory framework, but then there's another way that, you know, just because I might believe that doesn't mean my day is going to go poorly. Like, I can still live an interesting and fulfilling life potentially, but we all have these competing visions of what truth is. And there might be some QAnon truth. There might be some climate change truth. There'll be some, all these different truths. So in a world like that, is it possible to have a core central vision that society can self-correct itself and have this more equitable society, that if there's an outlying event that brings society into a non-equitable space, it kicks it back to this core vision?
I'm not entirely sure where you're placing references of equitable or quick kick it back. I'm not sure. But what I would say is no. I don't think it's possible for human beings to live in civilization without some unifying mythologies that they tell themselves. Mm-hmm. And at the limit, telling yourself that there is truth or there is some core reality that you can all discern and ontological reality, I think is false. That there is no way to determine ontological truth. That there is, this is a complicated conversation, because I believe that truth exists. First of all, I believe that there is a reality, ontological reality, but I don't think that we have the ability to discern it empirically. I think we approximate it and we develop mm-hmm. models to try and interact with the world. But those models are essential for understanding. And so we have to come to a certain consensus view of what models we want to work with. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is that the observation that we live in a subjective universe is correct. But that's not a model that we can all rally around and live with. We have to have things that we agree on in order to be an organized society.
Yeah, I guess what I was... And no, and that's a great answer. And so to take it possibly a step further, or highlight something that I wasn't able to explain perfectly the first time, is in our current framework, is it possible to have a more equitable society that's self-correcting, or are we going to need a completely different framework?
So in terms of self-correcting, I mean, there are certain things that our current society is struggling with. For example, it's something that I've talked about as the gravitational collapse brought about by an overwhelming amount of private sector debt. So this is one area where our economy has not been able to self-correct. I think it could self-correct theoretically, or it could have self-corrected at some point within our system, but the recurring bailouts, I think, moved us to a place where a self-correction at that point could have sent the system into some type of totalitarian model or socialist model of governance. So I guess in that respect, I should say this. So there was a time in my life where, and I think this also was true in the early days of the show, where I was looking for a system like that. Was there some kind of, not perfect system, but good enough system that was the ideal system to live under for eternity? And that this system was, in effect, self-correcting. That it wouldn't be without casualties, but more or less you would get some kind of steady state equilibrium over time. I have some doubts about that now.
What changed?
I don't know if I can point to any specific thing that changed. I think just looking at the world more, reading more history, thinking about the problems that we confront. You know, for example, is liberal democracy the system that is best for humanity at every single stage of its development, that might not be true. I mean, there might be, we certainly know that that's not true actually, because we fought the Civil War and suspended certain rights in order to do it. We fought World War II. And yes, we didn't lose our democracy in the process, but we compromise on many of the things that we take for granted during peacetime. And so I think different types of problems implore leaders and governments to make alterations. So I don't know. I think, you know, it remains to be seen. I think over the arc of history, human beings self-organize in all sorts of different ways. And it's hard to say what system is right for the entirety of, we've never seen human beings live under one system. So the idea that somehow now we've discovered it and it's liberal democracy is probably not correct.
Yeah. Yeah. If you look back at history, well, there's a lot of conclusions you could draw, but one of them that I seem to see this constant throughout all of history is humans are constantly looking for a better and better system. We are constantly striving or working forward, back, middle for a better form of governance.
Or the ideal.
Exactly. Some utopian form. and you know, it's in one part, it's almost tragic because we keep doing the same thing and never getting there. But another part, it's quite valiant because we keep trying even though we never succeed. And so it's this interesting dichotomy of some really core essence of humanity, which are both good and bad, I think. And so to kind of go further, you mentioned some periods in U.S. history where we, let's call them the period of compromise for liberal democracy, where we compromised values and freedoms for what at the time could be a narrative of for better values and freedoms in the future. You mentioned the Civil War, World War II. In one way, it feels like we're working towards, America's building towards some big monumental moment. I would love to be the only one who thinks or believes this, and I'd love to be completely wrong. And I'm just wondering if you feel the same way at all.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, towards one monumental moment, I don't know. But certainly...
Yeah, that could be a bit dramatic.
Yeah, but certainly we're moving towards a resolution. And by resolution, that I don't want to suggest that the outcome of that will be good or bad, but simply will resolve an unsustainable state of affairs, which is the state of affairs that we live in today. Though we didn't know it, that may have begun after the fall of the Berlin Wall, maybe sometime between the fall of the Berlin Wall and 9/11, though probably in the early part of the 1990s. Because I don't think the model that we've been living in since then really had the right mix of things that human beings need to live successfully in the world. And one example of that is an organizing narrative. The organizing narrative after the fall of the Berlin Wall has been something along the lines of some kind of utilitarian argument for mass consumerism and comfort. And that people would sort of be motivated by the desire of growing rich and just getting richer and richer. And ultimately, while that it would be nice if human beings were satisfied with absolute comfort, it's not true. People care about relative standing, number one. Number two, people care about more than just material wealth. You know, they need a unifying vision. They need a mission, both in their personal lives and I think in their national aspirations. I don't know if a society can organize in the form of a nation or a nation state without a unifying set of beliefs that bind them together. And in fact, what we have today is the opposite of that. What you see is that within the United States, we are tearing each other apart. The common enemy that we've identified is no longer from without. It's no longer the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany or the British or the South during the Civil War, which was internally divisive, but it was the Union against the Confederacy. It is now ourselves. And you don't really know exactly who the enemy is. You're always trying to discern who the enemy is. And so this is not a fundamentally sustainable state of affairs. And I think that's just one example of a mix of things that the United States has to resolve, the country needs to resolve, in order to bring us back to a place where we can, you know, live under a sustainable model for, again, an indefinite period of time.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you kind of highlight we are our own enemy currently. And a kind of subtext, a theme that keeps cropping up in certainly my thinking of all this is that if we've never once created the perfect system, perhaps not the system that needs fixing, but us. And so that really gets that point you just brought up. And so do you think about that of like, we're so focused on tinkering and fixing the system. We, number one, probably don't want to actually look at what is the heart condition of humanity, because it's easy to become distracted with this other project over here that has clearly never worked quite yet. Do you think about those two things at all?
Well, I've thought about that in the context of genomic science and notions of artificial intelligence and symbiosis. I think the issue you run into there in terms of advocating for the evolution of humanity in order to fit itself into an ideal system is, to what extent are you no longer human? And I think asking most people to support anything that would result in a race of humans or a species, a non-Homo sapien type evolved ape, would be that it's kind of like committing suicide in a way. Yeah. And it's interesting. Andrew Solomon wrote a book called Far From the Tree, where he talks about all of these aberrant cases of parents who have children who are deaf, homosexual, transgender, that have Down syndrome, et cetera, dwarf characteristics, to highlight the challenges and the suffering that emerges from having children that are sufficiently different from you. And we're talking about human beings here. We're not talking about alien species. And I think that does speak to like a real biological antipathy towards the kinds of things that you're describing. So I do think about it, but I think evolution is something that should happen over a long period of time, or that's how it historically has happened, so people are able to cope with it. But the idea of genetically engineering the human species or developing such exponentially advanced technologies that displace us or that empower a new race of humans who can use them to rule over the rest of us, I think that's frightening. I wouldn't want to be in either one of those positions, but certainly not the inferior one.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm also just thinking of simply, how do I treat my neighbors? And the idea of humility in not thinking less of yourself, but thinking about yourself less and thinking of others more. And just some really basic... one could say worldview, one could say philosophical ways of approaching yourself and your community around you.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. That is something that we absolutely need. I think we are living through an epidemic of narcissism in our society, and most people don't realize that they're being narcissistic. And I think ego is a huge problem. So I 100% agree. I don't know how you engineer that. I don't know how you convince people to be less concerned with themselves and more concerned with the common good. But that's an ideal to strive for.
I certainly don't know either. So a moment ago, you were speaking about the fall of the Berlin Wall. Things have really changed since then. And we're not, the fabric of America, the economy is not providing what its citizens need. And you mentioned vision as one of them. What are some of these other elements that are not being met?
Well, I mean, in terms of vision, I think it's not just on the national scale, but I think that people need something to aspire to. And I think nationally, people don't feel that. I think a lot of people in their personal lives don't feel that. I mentioned also the situation with the national debt, not the public debt, but the private debt, the collapse of private sector debt that happened in 2008, and the forces that intervened in order to prolong it, which are simply exacerbating the social and economic inequities in the country. I think, you know, something else that has developed in those years has been the growth and influence of surveillance capitalism and surveillance type technologies, and how they have managed to empower a new class of elites in positions of power that allow them to exercise a level of control over society that we would have considered worthy of the label national crisis had we been provided it with a thought experiment. In fact, we had been. Bill Joy wrote an article for Wired in 2000 titled "Why the Future Doesn't Need Us," where he examines some of these potential themes, not just in terms of AI and robotics and the way in which we thought about it with like the Terminator movies, but also what happens when a class of human beings is empowered with a set of technologies that are akin to magic. And I think that's where we are today. But because our models of corporate concentration are structured around this idea of monopoly and monopoly pricing, we don't really see it for what it is, because so much of the trade-offs are bartering. They are people bartering away their attention and their personal agency in return for clicks, in return for cheaper prices, maybe on some things. But it's a different model. And I think this may be, it's certainly up there with all the things that I'm most concerned about, but I think it actually would rank at the very top, because it's covert. We're not aware of how we're being manipulated, and our system of government requires the agency of the population. This is something, I know you've had Mike Green on the show. Mike Green talks about something similar when he talks about passive investing. So the way in which passive investing works is it has the embedded assumption that there are discretionary investors in the market who are pricing the assets competitively that you're purchasing systematically. But the problem is that when everyone is investing systematically, what does that look like? All of a sudden, there's a departure from value in investing. And something similar happens with democracy. When more and more people are checked out of the democratic process and sort of assume that someone else will handle it, we end up having, I think, what we have today, which is incompetence and corruption in government. And we've seen it with Donald Trump. We've seen it now with Joe Biden, who is an enormous disappointment in the situation that we're dealing with currently with Afghanistan. So I think what's particularly nerve-wracking about these types of technologies and this type of surveillance capitalism is exactly the fact that we can't easily point to it and draw that linear relationship between one and the other, cause and effect.
Interesting. And to help connect the dots for myself, it sounds like you're saying passive investing is interesting because it's almost reflexive, like everyone just passively invests. You have variable one and variable two, and this first one impacts the second, but then the second one goes back and impacts the first. And so it's like this reflexive loop. And I'm kind of putting this back to you to know if I'm correct here. I'm hearing you say that politics is almost similar in that the masses are just passively letting these leaders come into power, and then these leaders are impacting the masses again. And so it's almost like this reflexive cycle.
Yeah. So I think I unfortunately mixed up a few themes that are reflexive and self-reinforcing. But yes, certainly what I am saying is that the phenomenon that we see in markets with respect to passive and the idea of investing in the broader market because you can piggyback off of the work that discretionary investors do. Something similar has happened in politics and in American politics and in government, which is that over the decades, people have increasingly handed off their responsibilities to the broader public, which they have hoped would do the work of vetting the candidates and bringing to us the cream of the crop. Or I wonder perhaps if one of the reasons why we don't seem to see the cream rising, so to speak, we don't seem to find a lot of really great candidates out there, that this might in part have to do with the fact that people have checked out of the process.
Yeah.
And the more, yeah, exactly. I think to Why your would point, you wanna... the worse the candidates, the more people seem to check out.
Mm-hmm. Why would you want to be involved if you are truly someone of great quality and character? Why would you want to get in that mess?
There's also that as well. And social media plays a role there as well. And media and the denigration of candidates, the way in which the press has, I think, played a role in this as well. And again, this is not to attack the press as an institution. It's simply to acknowledge that the economic incentives of media have changed in such a way so that many of the most successful news programs or formats that exist reward bombastic, fear-mongering propagandists. And those people misinform the public, and subsequently the algorithms that present information to viewers and to readers are not built to choose content based on its informational accuracy or its benefit to the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
They are designed so as to garner the most amount of attention from the reader or from the viewer.
That's so interesting. It sounds like a glass ceiling for wholesome character. As in, imagine Jimmy Carter. A lot of people are going to disagree, but with this analogy, I shouldn't have picked a specific person, but he is known as being like the nicest president. Like that is some stereotypes. And so just imagine Peanut anybody farmer. Right now. Yeah. And that's a very interesting dynamic I have certainly thought of before, but not in that specific way, that it really is almost a glass ceiling for like these wholesome characters that is maybe what we need right now. Someone who's able to take the hits and make the tough decisions that's going to be bad in the short term.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that what we want is a wholesome. I think I agree with the very end of what you said. I don't know that we want a wholesome Jimmy Carter type character.
Yeah, no, I take that part back. But
yeah, or a nice guy. Yeah. I think what we want is
exactly.
We want a tough guy or a tough woman. This is inevitably where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna have a strong man or woman, and probably be a strong man because this is America. And the question is, will that person have good or bad intentions in his or her heart? And it won't be the first time. This is what I think, but goes back to my point about what societies need. Can a democracy go through, can it weather the type of storm that we are entering? A storm that is partly of its own making. Again, to the point about 2008, we wouldn't be in this mess if in 1998 or in 2008, we hadn't conjured so much wealth into existence, coddled financial markets, bailed out many bad actors who had contributed to or directly caused the crisis in the first place. And so by allowing these wounds to fester, we are now at a point where I don't know that our current system of government can actually handle the problems that we face. We need tough decisions. And the problem is that the type of decisions mm-hmm. that need to be taken are not decisions that politicians are willing to make, because politicians are accountable to the public and politicians want to get reelected and they like to do popular things. And the most yeah. popular thing is to lie to people. So lying to people is not actually—
Or give them money.
Now, in this case, one could argue that giving people money through fiscal transfers is actually part of the solution. It's not going to be pleasant for a lot of people, for millions of people. Again, they're going to be winners and they're going to be losers. But one could argue that in the current situation that we're in, with the overwhelming amounts of private sector debt and the use of monetary policy to basically prevent the gravitational collapse of all of this debt, we've created a sclerotic economy where people cannot actually work their way to prosperity because asset prices are so far and beyond anything that wages can purchase, that the only way to actually make it is if you have capital to invest in the Ponzi scheme that is the American financial system.
Well, you know, I want to go one step further and ask you, so I don't know your financial situation, your savings, but if you were just a regular person working one, two, let's say two jobs, making rent, housing's going up, food's going up, kind of your stereotypical place that a lot of folks are finding themselves in right now. And you knew everything you know currently, but you have no investments or assets. What would you do going forward?
I've never had anyone ask me that question. I feel like I need a lot of time to think about it. What would I do if I had zero assets? What about my income?
All your understanding of knowledge.
And what would my income be? I mean, would I have a strong income or would I be...
Well, I don't know. I mean, you can afford rent.
Okay, so I don't have enough. Like, okay, got you. I don't have enough to say.
You don't have a cushion.
Well, I mean, I guess I'd be trying to play the lottery, whether with whatever remaining money I have at the end of the month, and let's say buy some super convex cryptocurrency, which is exactly why so many of these various sort of Ponzi schemes exist in crypto, because they're lotteries to get you over the hump.
Let me just say, this show is not about investing advice.
Yeah, no, it's not investing advice. I'm also like theorizing here what I would do. But I still think you can do this. So again, I don't actually think that that's what I would be doing. I think what I would be doing is I would be investing in myself, trying to make it possible and sustainable for me to live passionately and to do the work that I love to do. And I would probably be spending whatever disposable income I had beyond that, beyond investing in myself and my business, whatever business it was that I was creating, I would be using it to have experiences, whether that was going to a nice dinner on an occasion, whether it was going on a vacation. Again, I don't know how much money I would be creating this hypothetical, but I don't think that what I would be doing is what I think some people do, which is YOLOing into investment opportunities with the hope of some convex payout. I would much rather be using that money in the here and now to enrich myself and to expand my own set of experiences.
And not to beat this dead horse, but would you be worried about the next 10 years of your purchasing power being eroded even further? Or like,
I would give up. Look, first of all, I don't think too much about the future. I mean, I do plan as a responsible adult for the future, but something I've talked about, I'm a brain tumor survivor. I understand very viscerally how quickly life, you know, moves by. It feels like yesterday that 9/11 happened. We're now on the verge of the 20-year anniversary. So I don't like to commit myself too much to the future because the future changes. I like to be prepared for it as best as possible, but I think it's much more important to be emotionally resilient than it is to try and save your money. Now, that's also a function of the current environment. If I were able to save more predictably and confidently, then maybe I would plan a bit more for the future. And I do plan, again, and I have the luxury to plan because I've done well. But again, if I were not in that position, I probably would plan a lot less and care a lot less about the future. And that, incidentally, it's ironic, because low interest rates create credit availability and provide businesses with the capital to invest in the future. And yet low interest rates also incentivize spending in the here and now. So in many ways, it's not coincidental that we find ourselves in the situation where people care less and less about the future. They're sucking from the future into today. And that's a dangerous dynamic that creates, I think, instability, both economically initially, but also in the long term socially.
So we spoke about hidden forces and we're going to wrap up soon. I'd love to hear a little more about it from your perspective and then where folks can find it. But I want to ask, what's in the back of your mind? Are you just chug along with hidden forces right now, or what are you excited about? Are there some things in the works? Like, what's, we just said, you just said you don't like to think about the future, but are there any exciting things in your plate you're looking forward to in the next bit?
Sure. I mean, insofar as my work is concerned, first of all, the longer I have a show like this that grows in audience size and reach, the easier it is to book the types of guests that I want to speak to. So I don't currently, for example, have the ability to regularly speak with the most powerful people in the world. I've had opportunities to do that on occasion. I've had the Secretary of Defense on the show, for example.
I saw that.
Yeah, which was super cool.
That's super cool.
And so I would love to get to a place where I can speak to the current Secretary of Defense or the current President of the United States. But I'm not there yet, so that's a goal to aspire to. I will soon be launching a newsletter that I call the Get Smart Newsletter. And it's going to be an opportunity for me to begin to put thoughts on paper, something I haven't done in a very long time. I used to write rather prolifically, and I have wanted to do it for a long time, but I've been rather disorganized. My wife is a systems thinking guru, so she is helping me slowly where she has the time and where I have where I have the patience. So she's actually all credit to her because she's making all of that possible. I launched a new music track with the show that was inspired by the soundtrack and original score from not just Stranger Things, but you know, Stranger Things was inspired itself from a compilation of 1980s type music from movies like The Goonies, Neverending Story, stuff like that. So I launched that music track recently, and that speaks to some of to where I feel like I'm taking the show.
Cool.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of things that I'm excited about. Look, some of what we talked about today speaks to the changes that we are bound to. We're seeing them, and we will see more of them. And so being in a position to talk about that and to speak to people's anxieties and to help construct frameworks for helping people navigate their way through these uncertain times is deeply meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. And I derive immense value from that, from hearing from people. I mean, as much as I love all different aspects of the show, arguably, I think what I love the most is getting emails from people, particularly young people, particularly people in high school or college, who say that the podcast has helped them, either in their work, in their lives, or both. So that's what I find most meaningful and exciting. And so I continue to look forward to doing that.
That's super awesome. And you do such a great job. And I'm sure you get comments all the time, but you've obviously, it's clear that you're comfortable in front of the mic. You do a lot of research beforehand.
Absolutely true.
Honestly, I've never had a guest before they come on hit me with so many questions like you did. And so it was really wonderful knowing you were going to be engaged and you were prepared. Not that I would have been worried, but it's clear that you put a lot of passion into this. And so that's exciting. Where can folks find this podcast we've mentioned so many times?
So they can find us on any major podcast platform. I mean, any. We're on Pandora, Spotify, Overcast, Apple, Google, wherever you want. We're also on many international airlines, including big Asian airlines like Singapore, Cathay, United, British. And you can also find us at our website. The website is hiddenforces.io. You asked me if I have anything exciting happening. We are launching new websites for both Hidden Forces and for Dimitri Kafinas, because dimitrikafinas.com it's like a picture of me from 2014. And it's just like a one-page thing that I built for $300. So we're going to be launching new websites, but you can visit hiddenforces.io and currently go through the entire episode library, going all the way back to episode 1. We now are at episode 207, I believe. And you can also follow me personally on Twitter at Kofinas with a K. And you can also follow the show at Hidden Forces Pod.
That's awesome. For all those long haul overseas airlines passengers.
That's also exciting. I get people. I love it. I love when people tell me, you'd be surprised to learn how many people have told me that they found Hidden Forces through an airline. And I wonder if there's... It must be, because way many more people have found us just, you know, going through one of, I would guess, maybe not, I don't know. I mean, the search and discovery function in iTunes and these other platforms is severely broken. And to the extent that it works, it's so true. And to the extent that it works, it depends.
Hopefully someone's listening.
Oh, yeah, I hope so. I hope someone from Apple's. I've been in touch actually with someone at Apple about this, but I never heard back. But to the extent that it does work, it depends on a narrow categorization. So for Hidden Forces, that's been a problem. We are not an investment show. We're not a marketing show. We're not a philosophy show. We're not a history show. We're not a politics show. And yet we talk about all this stuff. So maybe it is true that more people tend to find us on airlines. But what I think happens is when you're on an airline like United or Singapore and you see BBC World, NPR, you know, Tata TV, and then you see Hidden Forces, you just assume you put it in the same category as like the biggest brands in the world. So it elevates us. And I think people immediately say, wow, this is really cool. These guys are talking about something really interesting. Let me hit them up.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, that's a good score there. Dimitri, thank you so much for joining today. It's truly been a very fun conversation.
My pleasure, Bradford. For more information about this week's episode of Hidden Forces, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.